What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Heidi Ocean, talking about the new film Nikki's Family, that tells the story of Sir Nicholas Winton, a humble British version of Oskar Schindler who saved hundreds of Jewish children during the Holocaust. We'll also have a visit from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Guy Gelbert is off this week. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. July is often a quiet time in the Jewish world, or at least the synagogue world. It's as if everybody got together and decided it was time to go on vacation, and especially to avoid putting too much effort into their Judaism in this hottest month of the year. It's not that Judaism is any less compelling in hot weather. It's just that during the summer, people go off on vacations. Kids go away to camp. Everything seems less urgent. And Judaism is sort of an urgent religion. But the themes of this season on the Jewish calendar are actually fascinating and well worth exploring, whether or not our American observance pattern encourages that. Last week, we commemorated the fast of Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of the month of Av, which recalls the destruction of the first and second temples in Jerusalem. And this week, we begin the season of consolation for these historical losses, a period of time that begins with Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, and takes us all the way up to Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, which this year is on September 4th. Now, the ninth of Av itself is a day of incredibly painful associations for Jews, including the destruction of both the first and second temples in Jerusalem, separated by more than 600 years, but also including the fall of the Jewish stronghold of Beitar and the suppression of the Bar Kokhba revolt by the Romans, the last free Jewish state for more than 1,800 years, and the expulsion of the Jews from Spain that ended 1,000 years of a great Iberian Jewish civilization. Tisha B'Av commemorates profound national loss, and it does so in a unique and beautiful way. As a remembrance of last week's fast day of the 9th of Av, here then is a setting of the sad and powerful text of Al Naharot Bavel. By the waters of Babylon we lay down and wept when we remembered the destruction of Zion. Imesh kachech Yerushalayim, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, may my right hand lose its cunning. As sung by young Israeli sensation Medad Tassa.
שיר לנו משיר ציון, איך נשיר את שיר השם על אדמת נחור. אם אשכחך ירושלים, תשכח ימיני, תדבק לשוני לחיקי, אם לא אזכרכי, אם לא אלך ירושלים. Yeah.
That was Medad Tassa, now 20 years old, but much younger still when he recorded that version of Al Naharot Bavel, By the Waters of Babylon, so beautifully. You know, this text from the Lamentations after the destruction of the temple in the year 586 BCE has been set many times, each beautiful in its own way. From my own youth, I recall American singer-songwriter Don McLean, the guy who wrote and sang American Pie, recording a beautiful English-language version of this remembrance of the first great temple of the Jews by the waters of Babylon.
By the waters, the waters of Babylon, we lay down and wept for thee, Zion. We remember thee, remember thee, remember thee, Zion. By the waters, the waters of Babylon, we lay down and wept for thee, Zion. We remember thee, remember thee, remember thee, Zion. Of these we lay down and wept, remember and wept for these Zion. We remember thee, remember thee, remember thee, Zion.
That was Don McLean's lovely round by the waters of Babylon, Al Naharot Bavel, apparently made famous again now by the TV show Mad Men. First written 2,585 years ago or so, at least the text was, perhaps by the prophet Jeremiah in the Bible, it's also been recorded by the likes of Bob Marley. Before we leave the remembrance of the destruction of the temple, we do need to hear a very different setting of that same text by the great Baroque Jewish composer of Italy, Salomone Rossi. Rossi was the very first one to use polyphonic music in a Jewish context, and somehow this, nearly 400-year-old piece makes the somber text of By the Waters of Babylon sound almost festive. Al Naharot Bavel.
Zechor Adonai lignei
Salomon Rossi's Al Naharot Bavel by the Waters of Babylon. As we entered the period of consolation after Tisha B'Av with the beautiful Haftorah from the Shabbat service yesterday, the second Isaiah's words, Nachamu, Nachamu Ami, be comforted, my people. Those words should really ring true. As Jews living in the year 2013, we're encouraged to realize that the destruction of long ago has been redeemed, in large part by the creation of the magnificent modern state of Israel. We have a homeland and a thriving, innovative, beautiful, dynamic country in which 7 million Jews live. The temple has not been rebuilt, nor should it be, in my opinion. But the nation of Israel lives, Am Yisrael Chai, and our own extraordinary Jewish country of Israel redeems the losses of so long ago. May we always have cause to celebrate her. One sobering thought, we are now entering into a period of 6 weeks of consolation before Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. That also means we're just 6 weeks away from the High Holy Days. As a rabbi and cantor, this is a terrifying thought. Always, but particularly this year when Rosh Hashanah comes a couple of days after Labor Day, earliest in September I can ever remember it occurring. Of course, Rosh Hashanah falls on the first day of the Hebrew month of Tishrei every single year, but since this year September is early, we're beginning to get close to the High Holy Days. Not really close just yet, but close enough to begin generating the angst that always precedes the great festivals of the fall, all of them occurring in the month of September. Only about 45 more shopping days until Rosh Hashanah. In happier news, when we come back on Two Jewish This Morning, we'll meet our guest, Heidi Bogan-Ocean, talking about the wonderful new film, Nikki's Family, that tells the remarkable story of Sir Nicholas Winton, a humble British version of Oscar Schindler, who saved hundreds of Jewish children just before the Holocaust. The film came out this weekend, and it's extraordinary. Hear this amazing story when we come back on Two Jewish. Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Craig difference at Jim Craig Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all-new body style. It looks absolutely great. It's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a vent price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Craig difference.
We are delighted to welcome to Do Jewish our guest this morning. It's Heidi Ocean. She's speaking about a new film called Nikki's Family, which tells the forgotten story or nearly forgotten story of Nicholas Winton, an Englishman who organized the rescue of nearly 700 Czech and Slovak Jewish children just before the outbreak of World War II, saved all of those lives, and is responsible personally for something on the order of 6,000 people who are alive today because of his work during World War II. Heidi, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
So what attracted Menemsha Films to this story? How'd you guys find out about it?
We've had a relationship with the director of the film for some time, and Mate Minyak is very enthusiastic about this subject matter. It's kind of his passion. And he brought the film to us because he was looking for as wide exposure for the film as possible, because the story is so inspiring and so incredible. He came to us with the project so that we could reach the largest possible audience.
Now, the film was just released actually a couple of days ago, came out Friday, I think. Tell us, why wasn't this story picked up earlier? How come, you know, the story of Schindler was known, sort of similar to the Oscar Schindler story?
I think it's due to the kind of person Sir Nicholas Winton is. He derived absolutely no personal gain whatsoever from his actions, unlike Schindler, who exploited the labor. He saved people, but he also got some value for it. Nicky Winton did this as a matter of course and then went on. So I think that the story has been sort of buried under the layer of what's more sensational, and he's just a humble man.
Let's talk a little bit about how he managed to do this. Can you give us the background on Nicky Winton and how he got involved in the first place?
He was a stockbroker, and in 1939, he had a friend who was working in the Czech Republic, in Czechoslovakia then, who was working on saving adults and getting them out of the country by getting them documents. But he was only working with adults. Nick Winton and he were supposed to meet in Switzerland to go skiing, and instead his friend called Nick Winton and said, you know, maybe you ought to come here. There's a lot happening. When Nicholas Winton went to Prague, he saw the incredible need of rescuing from what was, he already sensed what was going to be happening to these people. And then nobody was dealing with the children. So he took it upon himself to organize rescues for those children.
We will talk much more with Heidi Ocean about Sir Nicholas Winton, about the movie Nicky's Family, and about the rescue of Jewish children before World War II and during World War II when we come back on Too Jewish in just a few moments.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio, or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. Last week, we had a lot of fun talking about and listening to the late, great Alan Sherman in honor of Mark Cohen's new biography of Sherman called Overweight Sensation. He was our guest last week. Well, there's a new CD by Rick Moranis called My Mother's Brisket and Other Love Songs. It's very much inspired by Alan Sherman, and it has its own unique charm. Here is Rick Moranis' unusual 7 Days of Shiva.
On the first day of Shiva, the Stolberg sent in the biggest potato kugel I've ever seen. On the second day of Shiva, the Katzmans had delivered two tureens of borscht and a bigger potato kugel than the Stolbergs. On the third day of Shiva, the Applebaum sent over three steamed pastrami's, two tureens of borscht, and an even bigger potato kugel than the Stolbergs or the Katzmans. On the fourth day of Shiva, the Resniks came and brought four pickled tongues, three steamed pastrami's, two tureens of borscht, and we had to leave their kugel in the hall. On the fifth day of Shiva, the Rubinovs dropped off five plates of smoked fish, four pickled tongues, three steamed pastrami's, two tureens of borscht, and we finally finished the Stolberg's kugel from the first day. On the sixth day of Shiva, the Greenwalds walked in with 6 pounds of liver, five plates of smoked fish, four pickled tongues, three steamed pastrami's, two bowls of borscht, and the Stolbergs came and we offered them some of Katzmann's kugel from the second day. On the seventh day of Shiva, the Keplers called and said that Sid Kepler died after seven operations, 6 days intensive quintuple bypass, 4 years of dialysis, three skin grafts, two hip replacements, so we sent in a nice potato kugel.
That was Jewish-Canadian comedian Rick Moranis. You may remember him from Second City Television and Great White North, or the movies Ghostbusters, Little Shop of Horrors, Spaceballs, or Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Anyway, that was his song 7 Days of Shiva from his new CD, My Mother's Brisket and Other Love Songs. Just love the line in the song about four pickled tongues.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, over the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about two countries, major players in the Middle East, extremely different, Turkey and Egypt, both going through something that feels like a revolution against a democratically elected Islamist leader. It seems to me that what's happening in both Egypt and Turkey, as different as they are, is that the coalition that overthrew in Egypt Mubarak, in Turkey that sort of ended up electing the Islamist Erdogan, was a coalition of people who didn't want the same thing. They didn't want the dictator Mubarak in Egypt. They didn't want the same kind of regime in Turkey. And so Islamists got together because they certainly wanted something different, with people who simply wanted a more modern state and didn't and wanted freedom and wanted personal expression. And it was a very strange alliance to start with. And as soon as the evil dictator was gone, or as soon as the regime was flipped over, they now are kind of in full conflict. And who knows which direction it's going to go. And I think the same thing's likely to happen in Syria, too.
Well, in Syria, you're absolutely right. But since we're talking about Egypt and Turkey, let me stress again, they're two very different cases. There was no evil dictator in Turkey. There was a series of democratically elected, fairly responsible people who were, in the case of Turkey, quite moderate and relatively uncorrupt, given the part of the world in which they live. And
right.
People were, by and large, guaranteed basic freedoms, except for members of some minority groups. There have been ups and downs, of course, with the Kurds and other very significant minority groups in Turkey. But the case in Egypt is different because There isn't a tradition of democratically elected leaders and smooth transitions the way there has been in Turkey since the 1920s. There was an Arab Spring in Egypt that demanded greater basic rights and was an expression of high expectations and many of the things you just said. And yes, there were Islamists and there were secularists and there were all kinds of people who were, for a variety of reasons, pro-change. And sometimes just pro-change for the sake of being pro-change, right, hoping that their lives would get better. When that goal wasn't realized in a very short amount of time, these people were frustrated, and it does look very much like they're going through a revolution. There's certainly dissatisfaction with the government, and it's not over, I don't think, in my view, any specific policies. It's not over the degree to which the government is or is not Islamist. It's over the speed or lack thereof in terms of social and economic change and profound changes in culture that make people think they have a stake in the future and that the government is being truly responsive. So the situation in Egypt is much tougher because there's less experience of democratic change to fall back on, and it's going to be much harder to satisfy enough people to produce a situation that looks peaceful and predictable. And the situation in Turkey is quite different. I suppose we'll talk about that next week, but it is, I mean, even the use of Islamist is questionable in the case of both, because it implies a commonality where I think none exists.
There's a broad range of what people think of. The Muslim Brotherhood is not the same as Al-Qaeda or something.
Right, right.
Well, Tom, we'll talk next week. Thanks.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sharon meets her friend Miriam, who has just gone through her third divorce. "Oh, you poor girl," says Sharon. "You must be shattered. I feel so sorry for you. Three times divorced." "Please don't worry about me," says Miriam. "I might not be the perfect wife, but I'm a very positive person. I still take great pride in all the things I know how to do very well." "Like what?" asks Sharon. "Well, for example," replies Miriam, "I know I'm a good housekeeper, and I'm proud to say it." "Don't take offense, Miriam," says Sharon, "but that doesn't sound so important to me." "Well, to me, it's very important," says Miriam, "because whenever I divorce a man, I always keep the house." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. You know, as a people, we Jews are good at many things. At kvetching, of course. At lashon hara, gossip, telling people things we shouldn't. And we're very good at eating. But perhaps most importantly, we Jews are good at asking good questions. Perhaps the greatest of all the Jewish questions was asked in this week's Torah portion of Akev, the third sedra in the book of Deuteronomy. It reads, Ve'ata Yisrael, ma'adonai sho'el me'imach, which means, "Now, Israel, what does God ask of you?" This passage in Akev then answers the great question, that you have awe of the Lord your God, walk in all of God's ways, love God, serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. That big question, what does God require of you? And our portion of Akev's answer begin a series of statements in Jewish tradition, attempts to distill from our large moral storehouse just what the essence, the ikar of Jewish ethics really is. What is it that God wants? What's the true standard we need to uphold to be considered morally good? The section in Akev lists a few things we need to do for God's sake. First, revere God. Second, walk in God's ways. Third, love God. Fourth, serve God with all our hearts and souls. And fifth and finally, we're told that we must guard and do all the mitzvot, the commandments of God. It's a clear and powerful list. Fear God, walk in God's ways, love God, serve God, follow the commandments. 500 years later, the great prophet Isaiah distilled even these terse commands from Moses' time into a more concise version. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good, he begins. And then he gets specific. Seek justice. Relieve the oppressed. Uphold the orphan's rights. Take up the widow's cause. Both more pragmatic than the earlier text and shorter. Isaiah says, seek justice, relieve the oppressed, fight for the widow and orphan. Of course, to start doing any of those, you must stop doing evil first and learn how to be good. That is, you must study so that you can properly know what goodness consists of. A century later, the prophet Micah refined the formula yet again. He asked, what does God seek of you? Only to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Simple, clear, and beautiful formulation of ethics. Do justice, love mercy, not domination. Walk humbly with God. Finally, Hillel, 400 years after that, just over 2,000 years earlier than we are today, said it most concisely, do not do to others what is hateful to yourself. All the rest is commentary. Now, go and learn. Do not damage others. Don't seek to destroy another human being, for you would never wish that upon yourself. Be sensitive and decent. And, of course, learn Torah. Study ethics so that you may best know how to live to this standard. Of course, the assumption is that you will adopt one of these magnificent formulas. Whichever one you choose, it will be a high standard on how to live your life. But it's one you can achieve if you choose to do so. After all, it's what God wants. So should we. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Heidi Bogan-Ocean, will explain how the moving film Nikki's Family came to be and the amazing, almost unknown story it tells about a wonderful British man. Find out what that is when we come back on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia. Out of surprise.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world. The European Union's bureaucrats have formulated elaborate new guidelines restricting trade and other interaction with any Israeli company or entity that does work in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, or any other area of Israel that's a disputed territory internationally. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu phoned European Commission President José Manuel Barroso last week in forlorn hopes of convincing the EU not to formally publicize its new guidelines on settlements. Israel believes the regulations will have negative ramifications on both the peace process and its ties with the EU. Netanyahu attacked the new measures and repeated his position that there were more burning issues in the Middle East, such as the Syrian civil war and the Iranian nuclear program, that needed to be dealt with first. The officials said that the two men agreed to continue discussing the issue. The guidelines will significantly restrict Israeli institutions from taking part in various EU programs and being eligible for EU grants, prizes, and financial instruments if they have activities beyond the Green Line. Netanyahu also spoke with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry about the EU guidelines. The prime minister reiterated his position that this type of European support for Palestinian maximalist demands will make it much more difficult to start direct negotiations with Palestinians. Netanyahu also spoke about the matter with French President François Hollande, Greek Prime Minister Antonis Samaras, Austrian Chancellor Werner Faymann, and Malta's Prime Minister Joseph Muscat. Those conversations were believed to be as much about placing Hezbollah on the EU's terror blacklist as they were about the settlement guidelines. Malta is the last remaining country to register opposition to calling Hezbollah's military wing a terrorist organization. Austria announced last week that it was dropping its opposition. European officials held a meeting on the matter on Wednesday, and the EU's 28 foreign ministers are expected to discuss the issue during a meeting next week. Israel's ambassadors in EU countries, meanwhile, were instructed to explain to their interlocutors the significance and ramifications of the guidelines, which are believed in Jerusalem to be understood by very few outside of the EU bureaucrats who drafted them. In other news, Egypt avoided a possible civil war this month, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said last week, making it hard for Washington to conclude that the overthrow of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi was a military coup. The armed forces deposed the elected leader on July 3rd after huge street protests against his rule, clearing the way for the installment this week of a new interim cabinet charged with restoring civilian government and reviving the troubled economy. Thousands of Morsi's supporters demonstrated outside the prime minister's office and marched through Cairo last week to protest against the military-backed administration and show that they had no intention of bowing to army dictates. Crisis in Egypt, which straddles the vital Suez Canal, has alarmed allies in the West. Washington would be forced to cut off aid to Cairo, including some $1.3 billion that goes to the military, if it determined Morsi had been removed by a coup. On the issue of a coup, this is obviously an extremely complex and very difficult situation, Kerry told reporters during a visit to Jordan, where he held talks with Arab officials, adding that Washington would not rush to judgment. What complicates it, obviously, is that you had an extraordinary situation in Egypt of life and death, of the potential of civil war and enormous violence, and you now have a constitutional process proceeding forward very rapidly. His comments underscored grave U.S. concerns about the Arab world's most populous state and suggested that President Barack Obama was in no hurry to pull the plug on the aid program. The leaders of the reform and conservative movements in the United States vowed to intensify their efforts to bring about the release of Israeli agent Jonathan Pollard after visiting him in Buettner's federal penitentiary in North Carolina last week. Pollard has not been in well enough health to receive visitors for several months now, but he made an exception for the reform and conservative leaders in a visit organized by young Israeli Executive Director Emeritus Rabbi Pesach Lerner, who has also led efforts to bring about Pollard's release. Union for Reform Judaism President Rabbi Rick Jacobs, the Reform Movement's Religious Action Center Director Rabbi David Saperstein, Rabbinical Assembly Executive Vice President Rabbi Julie Schoenfield, and Rabbinical Assembly former President Rabbi Alvin Berkin met Pollard for 2 hours and heard about his plight. The rabbis said they found Pollard in frail health due to his long incarceration and the range of physical ailments from which he suffers. They reasserted more strongly than ever that his release is overdue. They said that hearing the painful narrative of his long years in prison renewed their determination to help secure his release. Together, as representatives of the largest streams in the American Jewish religious community, the RA, RAC, and URJ, renewed their call for U.S. President Barack Obama to immediately commute Pollard's sentence and release him from prison. Pollard has served 28 years, the longest sentence for any individual convicted of similar offenses in the United States. And finally, hundreds of comments calling on Jews to leave Poland have appeared beneath news articles in the days since the country's parliament defeated a bill that would have reversed a ban on kosher slaughter first imposed in January. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Heidi Ocean is speaking about Nikki's Family, the brand new movie just released a couple of days ago that tells the remarkable story of Sir Nicholas Winton, a humble Englishman, a stockbroker, who organized the rescue of 669 Czech and Slovak children, Jewish children, just before the outbreak of World War II. Winton is still alive, 104 years old, shows up in the film, remarkably coherent. His rescue has now become better known, but it was really an under-realized story, in part because of his modesty. The film is beautiful and dramatic and extremely interesting. The children from the children whom Nikki Winton saved have now grown into a kind of worldwide family of something like 6,000 people today.
Let me correct you on that for 1 minute.
Please.
There were 669 children saved, but to date, only about 300 have been found. So it's the descendants of those 300 that now number 6,000. If we take into consideration the almost 400 other children, the exponential effect of what he did is huge.
Maybe more like 12 to 15,000 people.
Probably.
Wow. That's a decent-sized town that he saved, really.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about how this worked. Some people have heard of Kinder Transport, think that it was sort of an elaborate system that existed, that Western countries were saving Jewish children. It's not really true. Can you describe a little bit about how this worked?
No, in fact, he was not able to get any other country than England to work with him in this project. Nobody else wanted to participate in this. And the only way he was able to work with Great Britain during this was that he had to find sponsors for each of the children.
Every single child.
Every single child, and those people had to put up £50 for each child. He went to the Jewish community in London at the time, and they were already sensing unease, and they didn't want to be involved in this because they were worried about themselves. So he found people out in the country, simple people, who would just put up £50 and take one of the children.
Wow. And £50 was not an insubstantial amount of money in 1939.
Especially to the people in the rural areas of Britain at the time.
So how did, this is sort of a painful question, how did they decide which children to save?
You know, it was kind of a first come, first serve thing. And the biggest tragedy of the whole story is that his last transport that he had organized with 250 children was not able to be completed because it was scheduled for September 1, the day that the war broke. Out.
Right. That's when Poland was invaded. There's some really amazing footage in the film. It shows, parents giving their children up, knowing they'll never see them again.
Right. How, you know, that really pulls at everybody's heartstrings. And yet these parents knew that they were saving their children. Most of the parents did not survive.
Almost none, I think it says in the film. I don't know the statistics.
There were a few people, but not many.
In preparing this film, you know, Winton was, as you've noted, a humble man. He didn't really want the attention. How did he respond to that process?
I think he's been a little overwhelmed. From what I understand, as each of the children who were saved came forward, they adopted him as their father. So he has quite a large family at this time. I think he takes it in his stride, but I think he was a little overwhelmed at the outpouring of affection for him. You know, these children were placed in these rural homes, and they were young. They didn't know who saved them. They weren't aware of what happened. They just knew they went to England.
Were there other Kinder transports arranged by anybody else?
There were several others. These were the only ones from the Czechoslovakia.
Right.
There were several others from Germany.
Because some people have heard the term, which comes from, I think, the German transport.
Correct.
There's a really beautiful story. I'm tearing up. In the Czech Republic, in which 120,000 school children in the Czech Republic today, or almost today, signed the petition to nominate Nicholas Winton for the Nobel Prize for Peace.
Currently. currently we have over 214,000 signatures worldwide. We got involved in the Nobel Peace Prize campaign in January, and we've accumulated just in the U.S. about 40,000 signatures. And it's gone viral. It's was started by the children in schools in Czech Republic, and his name has been submitted by the legislature of the Czech Parliament has submitted his name.
You know, I don't know very much about the Nobel Peace Prize process. Sometimes it seems like fantastic people receive it. Sometimes it's a puzzling presentation. But I
one
can't
thing
think
that's
of...
important about the Nobel Peace Prize is that it's only given to living people.
Right, and he's 104 years old.
He's 104. He is planning his 105th birthday.
I don't mean that it's ridiculous. I just think it's fantastic.
It is fantastic. And, you know, maybe there is something about living well and doing good deeds that preserves you. I don't know.
How can people find out about this Nobel Peace Prize nomination process? What's the website to go to?
Well, they can go to our website, which is www.menemshafilms.com.
Can you spell that out? That's M-E-N-E-M-S-H-A. Films?
F-I-L-M-S, plural.
Right.
And go to our page for Nikki's family. There's a button to that you can click on to sign the petition.
This story, this comes out a bit in the film. The reason that people found out about this story had to do with Nikki Whitten's wife opening a suitcase in the attic?
Correct. He never even told her. She was 50 years later cleaning out the attic and stumbled upon a suitcase and opened it up and found all of his notebooks and albums.
You just wonder what that conversation was like.
Can you imagine? What? You didn't tell me?
Honey.
But what's remarkable about Nikki's family is that audiences... It's opened in L.A. and New York on July 19th. It has played 20 weeks in South Florida during the winter. It's now in its ninth week in Boston. Audiences across the country have just been remarkably impressed by the story, inspired. The overwhelming response has been so gratifying that we were able to bring such a story to the screen. It's truly an inspiring story.
It's won a number of audience awards, 14 audience awards, maybe more now at U.S. Film Festivals.
14 in the U.S., over 30 globally.
Terrific film. In producing something like this, it's a little different than other kinds of films, of course. How do you explain to people, distributors, obviously that's part of your job, is to get the film out there. What's your pitch?
Well, we believe that this film appeals to all ages and all audiences because it really portrays tikkun olam, or paying it forward, that the actions of one person really change the world.
You know, there's a famous Jewish teaching, if you save one life, you save the world. Nikki Whitten, Sir Nicholas Whitten, saved not one life, but almost 700 lives. And now you can sort of see in the numbers of descendants and the people that have continued on what a remarkable set of worlds have been preserved. What was the most moving story for you in the film?
I think the most moving story, which is portrayed in the film, is the mother who is troubled by sending her little daughter onto the train. She takes her off the train and puts her onto the train. As a mother, I can completely understand that torn feeling about, you know, do I keep my little child with me or do I let it go free and see, you know, into the world? That's a really touching story to me.
You know, it's a little different than sending your kid to camp for the first time, isn't it?
Yes. And we can all relate how tough that is.
Many of the children who were saved, but at least the ones that have come forward, have become involved in their own charitable work, in particular charitable work during tzedakah for children in other parts of the world, not necessarily Jewish children, mostly not. Some of that comes out in the film. very interesting connection and not necessarily obvious for people, I think.
I think that's really important to stress. If anything, the film does inspire each of us to find where we can help. We certainly live in a turbulent time, and there are lots of places that can use our assistance, and I think it behooves each of us to do something to repair the world, and I think that the film is a call to action in that regard.
One kind of practical question that I don't know if I got out of the film or not. After the children were relocated to, you know, villages and towns all over England, as you noted, mostly rural areas, with host families who would, you know, come up with a £50 a head, they were there, you know, throughout the war. The war in England was 6 years long. What happened to them right afterwards? Were they adopted by the families? Did Jewish refugee organizations get involved? What happens?
I think a little bit of everything. There were plenty of children who stayed with their foster families. There were plenty of others who, you know, some of these kids were teenagers when they went to England. By the time the war was over, they were young adults, and I think they were... They went their ways. Many came to the U.S. I think a large portion of the unfound children went to South America. And so those records are really hard to trace. But I think that a variety of things happened to these people, and I think it depended upon the age of the children.
I always wondered if some of the older kids ended up in the, you know, in the British service during the war, fighting against the Nazis.
I believe so, and I believe some actually emigrated to Israel during the war and participated then in the
liberation. 1948 war. Right? Yeah. Yeah, which they might have been, ironically, it would have been easier to go to England and then to go to England's colony, Palestine, than it would have been to try to get from the Czech Republic to Palestine.
Correct.
Very interesting sidelight. The film is called Nikki's Family. It's a beautiful, interesting film. How many cities are you going to be in?
As many as we can go to. Currently, as I said, we played in South Florida. It's played in Boston. It's
opened in L.A. and New York just this weekend.
The next plans are for Chicago, which will be at the end of September. Mm-hmm. And we're working in collaboration with the Illinois Holocaust Museum. And also the Rotarians, because Nick Winton was the first and I think only person inducted into the Rotarian Peace Hall of Fame.
See, there I thought belonging to Rotary Club all these years for me didn't have any connection in a Jewish way.
See, you share something with Nick Winton.
Yes, I wish I shared more.
We'll also be in San Francisco in the fall and Tulsa. A few other places.
Good luck with continuing to circulate it. What's the website that people can go to find out more about the film if they don't happen to be somewhere they can see it?
www.menemshafilms.com.
Heidi, thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest will be a great exemplar of social action, the wonderful Ted Mann. Our playout this morning comes from Julie Jacobs. It's the Yiddish classic Rabbeinu Tam. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Werden schwarze Jahr und rot an Liebesfriedene, a schöne Liebesfriedene, vor dem Rabbeinu Tam, vor dem Rabbeinu Tam. Heidai, heidai, dai, heidai, dai, heidai, dai, 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 dai,
geschrieben hat das Fribbele, die mal gewohnt herkam, geschrieben es mit Leuten,